Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Pat from
Pasadena.
All right.
Thank you, Pat.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, glad to be sober. I like the way I live my life today. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was going to like it much. But I do. I really, really do. I just need to say this up front and hopefully get it out of the way so I won't sob through the entire talk. I generally like speaking. I mean, what's not to like? You know, I'm talking about my favorite subject. But not so much the last year and a half. My husband died a year and a half ago. That's the first time I said that without bursting into tears. And I've really had a hard time talking since then. It's just hard. I feel bad. I feel really, really bad. My heart broke when he died. It really did. But here's the thing, if you're new, if you don't hear anything else I say tonight, I hope you hear this. I have felt as bad this past year and a half as a person could possibly feel, but not once has the thought of taking a drink crossed my mind. That's because I'm a sober, participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I am right smack dab in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous when that happened, so I couldn't, just fall off the earth. You know what I'm saying? And so if you're new, I hope that you I hope you stay here. I hope you find what I have found and others in this room have found. Because the day will come, when your life falls. Everybody's got their turn in the barrel, you know. Might not be a death, but it's going to be something. And I hope and pray for you that you're in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous when it happens to you. Anyway, I started drinking when I was 13. I grew up in Newport Beach and I was drinking at beach parties and, you know, whatnot. And, you know, I drank the first time because I was at a party. People were drinking. I just wanted to fit in. I didn't have any strong feelings about drinking or not drinking. I just wanted these people to like me. And so I drank. It was rum and coke. And I drank it. And the magic happened for me that I assume happened for you if you're in a meeting. And that is that it changed how I felt. It changed how I felt about me. And it changed how I felt about you. I've always described myself as being incredibly shy. You know, I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know, people do social chit-chat. I don't get that at all. And so I've always described myself as being shy. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you call things by different names. You call that one self-obsession. I prefer shy. Shy implies I can't really help it, it's not my fault, you know, but the truth of the matter is I am self-obsessed. I think about me all the time. How do I look? How do I sound? How do I feel? What are you thinking about me? When I'm having a conversation with you, it's hard for me to listen while you're talking because I'm busy thinking about what I'm going to say when you pause for air. That's not really, you know, having a conversation. And so I'm at this party, I drank that rum and coke, and it all went away. I completely relaxed, I think, for the first time in my life. I mean, really relaxed, more than relaxed, you might say. I don't know how much I drank that night. When you're 13 and you never drank before, it probably didn't take all that much. But however much it took, I drank that much and then some, which is how I drank until I got here. I felt like I was the life of that party. I felt like I was the best dancer there. It was really magical. Now, I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know, which was a lot more than I meant to do that night. You know, I felt bad the next day. I felt bad. I was terrified I'd get pregnant. I was embarrassed and ashamed. And yet I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a second thought. I was apparently willing to pay the price to drink from the gate. I say apparently because I certainly didn't think any of this through at the time. If it sounds, as I'm telling my story, is this my water here?
Yes.
You could have got me a big one. If it sounds, can I get a cup? This just seems like it would be so unladylike to drink out of this bottle. Like I've changed or something. Trying to put on airs here. I forgot where I was. Oh, I was talking about insight. If it sounds like I have insight to the way I was living my life, believe me, I didn't have it then. It all came after I got sober. Anyway, you know, I was a pure addict for a while, mostly because I was 13, 14, 15 years old. I didn't have access to alcohol every day, but I right away gravitated towards the people who did or who knew how to, you know, we found the one liquor store in Newport that would sell to minors out the back door. And, you know, before I got drunk that first time, I was a straight-A student, and I was going to church on Sundays, and I was real involved in a church youth group, and I did those things because I wanted to do them. You know, I wanted to be a good student. I wanted to be a decent person. And, you know, I got drunk and that night and subsequently, and my life changed. Within 6-9 months, I was getting C's and D's in school. I quit going to church, dropped out of that youth group, had a whole new set of friends. My life had changed. My parents noticed this, and they sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of high school, which had the desired effect. It was a very structured girls' boarding school, and it was actually not all that far from here, San Luis Rey. And I guess I have no idea of what direction is what, but anyway, San Luis Rey. It was a very structured place, and I think... For me, and I think for most alcoholics, when we're applying ourselves, we work harder than anybody. The trouble, of course, is we don't apply ourselves very often. But when I was in that boarding school, because it was so structured, because it was very difficult to get booze, there were no boys there, which was very distracting to me, I studied, and I brought my grades up, and I graduated at the top of my class, and I went to moved back home, and I went to a local college, and I got married when after that first year of college. I got married because somebody asked. I'd like to give you a better reason, but I've searched my heart over the years. There just isn't. We got married, and, you know, when we were dating, I lived at home with my parents, he lived at home with his parents, and so the money we had from our little jobs that we had, we spent partying and drinking, and now we're married, and we have to pay rent and, you know, food and utilities and stuff, and so we didn't have money to drink. In retrospect, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, as it describes in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed a drink. I didn't, of course, know that at the time. I just knew that I wasn't very happy. I don't ever remember fighting with him or arguing with him. I just was restless, irritable, and discontent. While we were married, my brother, I had one brother growing up, 3 years older than me. My brother was in the Navy at the time, and he... his ship was in Japan, and there was an accident on board his ship. He was very badly injured. They took him off the ship, put him in the hospital in Japan, and the ship sailed. And the Navy Department was sending my mother telegrams about his condition, which was very, very serious. And nobody in our family could afford to go there to see him. So I started sending him cards every day, funny cards, anything. I mean, he was in a foreign country, didn't speak the language, and was alone. His ship had sailed. He didn't know anybody. So I started sending him cards every day, hoping to cheer him up a little bit. And about a month went by, and my mother got another one of these telegrams saying that his condition had improved enough. They thought they were going to be able to ship him back to the States. He'd probably be in the San Diego Naval Hospital, which was... you notice how I keep pointing that direction? Is that the right direction?
Yeah.
Oh, good. See, I'm not as... Okay. So they thought he might be in the San Diego Hospital. So we were very excited about that, because, of course, it meant we'd get to see him. And we kind of celebrated that news. And around the time we got that news, I sent another of these many, many cards I'd been sending to him. It was intended to be funny. On the front, it said, "Heard you were ailing, but not to worry." And on the inside, it said, "Only the good die young." I sent it, and he died. I don't think I could have felt worse if I'd killed him myself. I really, honest to God, couldn't believe I'd done such a stupid thing. I felt so terrible about that card. My prayer was that he died before that card got there, the mail being what it is, you know, the mail service. And so I prayed every day that terrible, terrible card didn't arrive. When his trunk of belongings got shipped back to my mother, she opened it up, and that card was in there. It had been opened. I took it when nobody was looking. I went in the bathroom. I ripped it up in little pieces and flushed it down the toilet and just cried and cried and cried. I felt so bad about it. I tell you that story because I never told it to anybody. That happened when I was 19. I got sober when I was 30. I never told anybody that until I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous. because I couldn't. I just felt so terrible about it. And that's how I lived my life. It became one more secret on top of secrets that were already in there. There's so many benefits from being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, obviously being sober, the biggest one, but in addition to that, the idea that my life is a completely open book, I have no secrets. I have shared my deepest, darkest secrets that I was going to take to my grave, literally from podiums all over the country. My life is an open book, and the things that I was most ashamed of are the things that, and our book talks about this, and I don't even attempt to quote the book because I don't do it very well, but it talks about the fact that our most horrible things become the things that, you know, that we will use to help others, and that has been the case for me, for sure. Anyway, so now I'm crying all the time because my brother died, and married to this husband, and we're 18, 19 years old, and we might as well have been 12 for all the maturity going on in our house. And he said to me one day, "I don't know how to help you get over the grief about your brother's death. Maybe you should go stay with your folks for a while. Maybe your mother could help you get through this. I just don't know how to help you." And he was trying to help. He was not trying to get rid of me. He was genuinely trying to help me. So I said, okay. And I went to my parents' house, and I never lived another day with him. I divorced him. He didn't quite know what had happened there. And he called, he wrote, he offered to go to marriage counseling. I couldn't even talk to him because I didn't know what was wrong. I just knew that I couldn't go back. I knew that I could not go back into that house with him. Again, in retrospect, I needed a drink. I needed to drink. So I divorced him. Now, clearly, this would be somebody, when I got sober, that I would owe amends to. I didn't see him. That happened, as I say, when I was 19. I got sober when I was 30. I didn't see him all that time. And I saw him when I was sober about 6 months. And I thought, wow, this is kind of incredible. Here I am, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God drops this guy in my path after all these years. This is a real opportunity to make amends here. And my next thought was, you know, I'm not sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet. And I let that opportunity pass by. I'm sober. Next month, I'll be, God willing, I'll be sober 34 years, and I haven't seen him from that day to this. I always like to tell that story when I talk, because I wish that I had made the amend when I had the opportunity. It is my strong recommendation when opportunities to make amends present themselves that you do it. I sure wish I'd done that one, and I hope God gives me another shot at it. Anyway, I divorced him. I moved up to L.A. and got a job and an apartment. And it's really the first time in my life now that I'm completely on my own, don't have a husband or parents, or, you know, I'm on my own. And from the very first day, I became a daily drunk. I was working as a secretary at a trucking company, and I drank with these truck drivers. When I drink, you know, it never got better than that first night I told you about. When I drink, well, I'm a friendly girl. Let's put it that way. So before I left that trucking company, I knew most of those drivers in the biblical sense. My parents were divorced when I was very young. My real father was vice president of that company, which is how I got the job. You know, when you're young and I had these really good secretarial skills, but I'd never actually worked on a job, and it's hard to get that first job. So I called my dad and I said, "Would you give me a job?" And I remember him saying, "Oh, I don't know, honey. I'm kind of reluctant to hire a family member." I know later on he wished that he had listened to his instincts there, because I went to work there and I really embarrassed and humiliated my dad a lot. He called me. The agreement we made was that I could have a job for a year, and then it would be a good solid job to put on a resume, and it was a good opportunity. I was grateful for it. But I actually wound up leaving before the year was up. He called me one day. I'd been there maybe 6 or 8 months, and he called me one day and tried to talk to me about me and how I was behaving. And I don't know about you, but I can't look at any of this stuff too closely, and I have to defend my right to drink. And so I said some really ugly things to him on the phone, and the end result of that conversation was we didn't talk again except when absolutely necessary at, like, weddings and funerals and things, until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and made amends to him. But I wound up leaving that job before the year was up because I was so embarrassed. When you behave like that, you know, you're going to be embarrassed. There's just no way around it. And so I began then my career as a secretary. And, you know, I could stay just about a year on a job, never longer than a year. And if I'm working at this company, you're my coworkers, and you are the people I work with, you're the people I drink with, You're the people I sleep with or your spouse. It doesn't matter to me until I've created such an ugly mess here that I have to leave. I can't face you in the light. I've quit, and then I moved to my new company, and you're my new friends. And I never speak to you again. And I'm sure you're glad, actually. Here's how I drink. I went out with my boss and coworkers one night. We're bar hopping around downtown LA. Now, everybody was drunk. I wasn't the only person drunk that night, but apparently I was a little bit drunker than the rest of them, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. Did somebody bring me a cup? They didn't. Oh, they figured I just... What the hell? I know you understand this. I know you will understand it when I tell you. We were the stage was like here, and we were sitting there, maybe 8 or 10 of us in our group. We were sitting at this round table directly in front of the stage, and I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall, sort of behind the stage, and ran into the owner of the bar in the hallway there and made some kind of derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment out there. And he said something like, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which evidently I thought. So, remember, a moment ago I was sitting at the table there dressed kind of like I am now. Thank you very much. Sitting at the table with my boss and my coworkers dressed kind of like I am now, and then moments later I'm on the stage dressed in essentially nothing. And there was a moment when my boss's eye and mine met, then when he realized who that was up there. I will never, ever forget the look on his face as long as I live. Truly will never forget it. When I sobered up the next day, I was semi-appalled at what I had done. I mean, a strip joint, for God's sake. But it kind of gave me an idea. This is kind of at the height of popularity of go-go dancing. And in my mind's eye, go-go dancing seemed to cut above stripping. It's not, but it seemed that way to me. All the nice clubs on Sunset Strip had go-go dancers. I didn't work there. My first paid job as a dancer was a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody there who spoke English. I don't even know how I got the job, but I did. And then I moved uptown to a place, I thought it was uptown because they spoke English, to a place that was kind of on the outskirts of Chinatown in downtown L.A., which is another way of saying it was kind of on the outskirts of Skid Row, because that's kind of a fine line going there. I met the man who was to become my second husband there at Nick's. He was a customer, clearly somebody who recognized talent. possibly the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. And so, of course, we moved right in together and eventually got married. And now we're married, but I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and so I'm pretty much still behaving like I'm single. And I don't mean to be doing that. I always meant to be a faithful wife. You know, I never meant to be living like this, but I am living like this. So we had a lot of trouble in our marriage. A lot of trouble. I would not come home after work, or I'd call and say I'm going to stop for a drink with the girls after work. You know, I don't know about you, but I've turned down drinks when I've known there was only going to be a drink. One time that husband and I were we were supporting this political candidate, and we had sent for some tickets to this event to support this candidate that was being held at a private home in Beverly Hills, a big, big event. And so we sent our money in, and the tickets came in the mail on like a Monday or something, and the thing was on Friday. And on the ticket, it said 2 complimentary glasses of champagne per person. I looked at those tickets every day, and then I called the place where, I can't even believe I did this, I called the place where the event was being held. I didn't tell them who I was, of course, but I said, I'm coming to your thing there tomorrow night, and I see that it says 2 complimentary glasses of champagne here. I'm just wondering if one wanted to purchase additional glasses, could one do that? And the woman said no. I said, okay, thank you. And I went to the event, and I know I can't be 3 or 4 hours at this event on 2 glasses of champagne. I know that. So I got a Diet Coke, and, you know, hid somewhere behind a potted palm or something, feeling incredibly ill at ease, because that's how I feel when I'm sober. And when my husband finally said, "Are you about ready to go?" I went over to the bar. I've already paid for my drinks, so I'm going to have them. Went over to the bar and drank my two glasses of champagne because I know now I'm going home and I can continue this drinking for tonight. And that's how I drank, you know. I started getting arrested. I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach. Well, I was from Newport Beach. I hadn't been a nice girl actually in a long time, you know, but I just didn't see it clearly. My first arrest was on Thanksgiving night. I had been to dinner at my parents' house in Newport. My parents were very upset about this marriage, to the point that they never met him. They felt quite strongly about it. So I had been invited to their house for Thanksgiving. My husband had not been invited, so he had gone to an event in Los Angeles. His boss had a party for those workers, and so he had gone to that party in LA. I'd gone to my folks. I got very drunk at my parents' house. I was driving home. I stopped for a drink and some cigarettes on Main Street in downtown LA, which is Skid Row and is not in a direct line from Newport Beach to where I was living, but whatever, that's where I was. And I came out of the bar and hadn't got to my car yet, and I got arrested for common drunk. They took me to Sybil Brand, and now there's a scary place. I was in way over my head. They said I could make a phone call. I remembered that my husband was at this thing at the boss's house, so I called over there, and the boss's wife answered, and I identified myself, and I told her that I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not occur to me it might have been nicer just to ask to speak directly to him to deliver this happy news. And yet, you know, years later, when I finally made it to Alcoholics Anonymous and heard you talking about making amends, I sat in meetings a long time seriously thinking, I don't think so. I don't really think I hurt anybody. I can't think of anybody that I hurt. And I really believed that for a long time. You know, I just, I really am selfish and self-centered to the max, you know. Anyway, you get the drift. Things were not going well. I started kind of, for the most part, drinking at home. My husband was a gambler. He was gone at the racetrack a lot at night, and that was by now just fine with me. He would go off to the track, and I would, you know, when he was there, I felt obliged to, he drank, obviously. I met him in a bar, and I would never have married anybody who didn't drink, but it turned out he didn't drink as much as I did, and my drinking kind of got noticeable. And so when he was there, and we were spending an evening at home, I felt obliged to make the drinking look different, you know. For example, scotch is my drink of choice, although I'll drink anything, but scotch is my drink. So you go in the kitchen, you put some ice in the scotch and some water. There's like kind of a right color that a drink should be. Not entirely sure what that is, but I know there is. And then back out to the living room with this drink. Now, this is the hard part. There is a reasonable period of time that this drink should last. I don't know about you, but to this day, hand me a glass of milk, and I'm just like, it's gone. I mean, that's how I drink. And so it just seemed like it was very stressful, is what it was. When he was gone at the track, it was just a lot easier. I just take that bottle of scotch, put it on the table beside where I sat, and, I mean, I used a glass. I'm not a common drunk, but dispensed with ice and water and all that good stuff. This is how I drank. We had a friend, Eddie, who I'm sure was an alcoholic. He, whenever he came over to our house, you know, he would just drink everything in sight that I wasn't drinking. And one night, my husband was a chef, and so he got vendors at Christmas time would give him bottles of booze as gifts. So it was around Christmas time, and we had all this stuff that he'd been given, and somebody had given him this bottle of brandy. So Eddie and I opened this bottle of brandy one night, and we drank it down. And Eddie called the next day, and he said, "Oh my God, that is the worst stuff I ever drank." He said, "I was so sick last night. I threw up all night. I had raging diarrhea." Now, it did all that to me too, but I started buying that stuff because I knew Eddie wouldn't drink it when he came over. I don't think that's social drinking. I could be wrong. So I started drinking it, as I said, at home, and I turned into one of those people who, because I was alone a lot at night, I would play those sad records over and over and over again. I was personally very fond of Ray Charles' Born to Lose. Wonderful drinking song to feel sorry for yourself. And sometimes I'd get the idea to call people on the phone. If you were a caller or in Al-Anon, you know that the notion to make these calls never comes at 7:30 in the evening. It's usually 3 in the morning and somebody completely inappropriate. I've heard speakers say that they called the White House and demand to speak to the president. I would never do anything like that. I called people I knew. Boyfriends I had when I was 12. You know, I wonder what Danny's doing these days. And, of course, I have no idea where Danny might be living these days, so I wake up 30 other people in my quest to find him. And I'm sure that Danny and his wife were just thrilled to hear from me when I finally did catch up to them. I hated myself. I hated my husband. I hated my life. The thought occurred to me that nothing good was ever going to happen to me the way I was drinking. And so, this isn't rocket science, I'll quit drinking. And I began that business of trying not to drink on my own, and I couldn't do it. I simply couldn't do it. You know, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be filled with firm resolve, I'm not going to drink today. I'm really going to get my life together. And I'd get dressed and go to work, and I've always had a little job to go to, and believe me, at the end, it was a little job. But everybody knows alcoholics don't have jobs, so that little job got real important to me. Anyway, I'd get dressed and be driving to work and think, not only am I not going to drink, but I'm going to go back to college and finish my education. And I'd pull in the parking lot at work. My last job, I was a clerk at a YMCA, and I think, I'll take some of these classes at this Y and get physically fit. It's going to be a whole new life. It's going to be great. But I'm an alcoholic, and assuming that I made it through lunchtime without drinking, which is about a 50-50 shot, maybe I do, maybe I don't. Either, you know, it's not good to drink at lunchtime, particularly when you're working in a place where people bring their small children. Meeting time. So I tried not to drink at lunchtime, and assuming that I got through that, I would go home, and more often than not, there'd be a half a fifth of scotch sitting on the kitchen sink, and I don't know about you, but I think it's going to be pretty hard to quit with this open bottle sitting here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to drink this down. Tomorrow there'll be nothing in the house, and then I'll quit. Only in an AA meeting would people nod their heads when you say something so ridiculous, you know? Of course, I'm an alcoholic. As the level of that bottle goes down, I'm calling the liquor store to deliver a new one, and tomorrow I have more or less a half a fifth of scotch again. And I did that again and again and again. I meant it every time. I am not going to drink today, but I did. One hot summer day, it was this kind of weather, you know. It was 10 in the morning. For some reason, I remember it was 10 in the morning. I was very drunk. I was sitting in my purple flannel bathrobe, which was my drinking costume for my final years. We lived in a second-floor apartment. You could see into, from my chair, I could see into the neighbor's backyard. The neighbors were a young couple about my age, late 20s, I think, at the time, and they had two small children. The kids were running back and forth in the sprinklers on the lawn, and the parents were sitting on the back porch steps watching their kids play and laughing and talking, and I cried watching those people that day because that's how I meant to be living my life. I never, ever meant to be living this terrible, terrible life that I am living, and I knew that day beyond a shadow of a doubt that if God somehow swooped in my apartment and handed me that life that those people next door have, that I couldn't do it. Because, as I said, I'd already been trying not to drink, and I simply couldn't do it. I don't know how long it was from that day until the day I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in blackouts a lot. I love speakers who say, you know, and then in 1962, I think it was a Tuesday, I don't know, you know. So at some point, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was drunk when I called. A real nice man answered the phone at central office, asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry. And he stayed on the phone with me a long time, told me a lot about himself, and told me where a meeting was. He said, "Do you think you could not drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night?" And I said, "Yes." Now, I actually doubt that I can not drink tomorrow because I drink every day, but yes is obviously the right answer, so sure. So he told me where our meeting was. We hung up, and I continued to drink until I passed out. And I woke up the next morning, and I remembered making the call, and I found the piece of paper where I'd written the address of the meeting hall down. Now, in the light of day, I thought I'd been a little premature. Only 30 years old, I was almost certain that's too young to be an alcoholic. But I couldn't get it out of my mind all day. I just kept thinking about it. And that night, I heard myself saying to my husband, at the dinner table, "I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight." He said something really loving, like, "Yeah, whatever." went off to the tracks, kind of how we were getting along. And I got dressed with some care, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always wanted to be dressed appropriately wherever I go. And, of course, I've never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I have no idea how that might be. And I just remember, women will understand this, I just remember when I left the bedroom, there was this pile of clothes on the bed that I had tried and discarded as obviously not striking quite the right note. I guess in the end I decided to go for comfort, because what I came to you in was rubber thongs and on my feet and baggy jeans and a knit top that had no knit left in it. It was very comfy. I wore that to meetings. I had a red one and a blue one. I alternated. I was clean. But that's what I wore to meetings for about the first, I don't know, 3 months maybe. And nobody ever said a word about how I was dressed until one night I was running late to the meeting, and I didn't have time to go home and change into my meeting clothes. And so I went dressed in what I was dressed in that day from work, which was a very pretty, soft, rose-colored pantsuit. And I think 300 people that night individually said to me, "My, you look pretty tonight." And it made me feel good, and I started dressing better after that. But anyway, to go back to this first meeting, I'm in these terrible clothes. It was an 8:30 meeting, so of course I got there at 8:28. I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said don't drink, so I didn't drink. Often by 8:30, I'm already passed out. So I was not feeling very well by the time I got to that meeting that night. I was sick and shaking. I'm in these terrible clothes. I'm drenched in sweat, which was this kind of side effect of drinking I had. I thought it was a gland thing, but once I was sober a while, it just went away. So I go, it's 8:28, I get to the door. There was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, "Hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And it made me feel welcome. I think it's the most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting, truly. I had no idea that man was to become a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. You know, no idea at all. I went in the room, and I'm standing in the room, sweating. I'm about to cry any minute, and a man came up and asked me if I was new, and I thought, how did he know that? And knowledge that I was, and it seemed like that. There's about 50 women coming at me, and they're all writing their numbers on little scraps of paper and just so excited to see me, and got me a big book and a seat, and it was a big meeting, 300 or 400 people probably, and so I'm sitting in the back of the room, and it was a speaker meeting, and the speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm A., and I heard him. Two things I really, really remember from that night. One is that at one point, because he talked really, really fast, I was sitting way in the back of the room, and at one point I realized I was leaning forward in my chair so I wouldn't miss anything that he said, and it struck me that I really, really was interested in what was going on here. And the other thing that I remember clearly from that night is laughing really, really hard at something that he said, just roaring with laughter. And, of course, I was laughing laughter of identification, but I couldn't remember ever having laughed that hard. When the meeting was over, the minute we said the Lord's Prayer and these two people on either side of me dropped my hands, I was out that door. There is no way I could have stood around to chat with you after the meeting. But I did buy the big book that night, and I took it home, and I sat up most of the night reading it. And I remember thinking, this is great. I'm gonna go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say go to a lot of meetings, and I thought every Saturday sounded like a lot. I drank again on Friday. Now, on the one hand, Saturday to Friday, 6 days in a row, I didn't drink. And I was impressed. I really was. I remember thinking, wow, AA really works. I mean, this is amazing. I hadn't been sober 6 days in a row in a long, long, long time. But on Friday, I was drunk, and I went back to the meeting Saturday, raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety, and I got some more phone numbers, and one of these ladies suggested I actually call one of them, which, of course, I hadn't done. I drank a couple more times that week, and I called that woman who said that to me. I was drunk when I called her, and she said, "You might want to get a sponsor. You don't seem to be doing too well on your own, and most of us have found sponsors to be kind of helpful." And I had no idea what a sponsor was, which is just as well, because I would never have asked her if I'd had any idea what was going to happen. I said, "Well, how exactly would you do that?" And boy, she leapt on that. "I'll be your sponsor." Okay. So she said, "Meet me early tomorrow night before the meeting and bring your big book." So I did that, and the first thing she did the next night when we met is she took my big book, handed me a pen, opened it to the front cover, told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote that date in there. She said, "That's your sobriety date." I remember thinking, I shouldn't have done this in ink. I don't think this is going to be my sobriety date. I'm very happy to report that that is my sobriety date, August 28th, 1975. The next thing she did is she took the meeting directory that lists all the meetings in the area, and she circled a meeting for every night of the week. She didn't suggest that I go to a lot of meetings. She didn't recommend that I go to a meeting every night. She said, on Monday night you'll go here, on Tuesday night you'll go there, on Wednesday night we go here. I stopped her about midweek there, and I said, you know, I'm a married woman. I can't do this. I can't go to a meeting every night. My husband would have a fit. And she said, well, maybe you can do it on less, but not with me as your sponsor. She said something like, if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. She said, I'll never ask you to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't done, but this is what I did. Boy, talk about standing at the turning point. I agreed to do what she said, and I think about it now, and I can't believe that I agreed to do it. If you're new, this part's important. I didn't agree happily, and I didn't do it happily, but I did it. Thank God attitude doesn't matter. If attitude mattered, you'd certainly have a different speaker, and this would be a much, much smaller meeting, guaranteed. It's a program of action. If I just, however I'm feeling at any given moment, if I take the action, I'm going to feel different, you know, after I've done it. And so I began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to meetings every night, and I was right. My husband didn't like it at all. He thought that I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, it's true, I had noticed that there were men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of you looked interesting to me, but none of you were looking back at me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. And it also made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something I wasn't actually doing right at that minute. You know, so I felt kind of sorry for myself. I cried all the time. I really did. I cried at every meeting I went to. We would have dinner. We'd have this big argument about me going to the meeting. I would get in the car sobbing hysterically from the argument. I'd drive to the meeting and I'd think, you know what? If this is sobriety, you can have it. This is miserable. I might as well be drunk. I hate him. I hate my life. It's awful. I'll go to your stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight. This is the last one I'm going to. I was told I had to get to every meeting an hour early, and I had to have early commitments like chairs or cookies or coffee or something, and I was to do my commitment and then wander around the room and shake hands with other people as they got there, ask them how they are as though I care. And so I'd sob all the way to the meeting, and I'd go in and I'd slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my job was, and then I'd go out and, you know, hi, Elaine, how are you? And she would say something like, fine, how are you, Pat? And I would tell her how I was, you know, in great dramatic emotional detail, sobbing, you know, until her eyes would glaze over, and then I'd move on, you know, hi, how are you? And that's what I did for an hour. You know, mercifully, eventually, the meeting would start, and I'd get some relief from myself. I went to a lot of speaker meetings, and I'm grateful for it, because I got nothing out of discussion meetings when I was new, because we're sitting in a circle at a discussion meeting. It's coming around this way towards me. I don't hear what any of these people are saying, because, of course, I'm thinking about what I'm going to say when it's my turn. Now it's my turn. I say something. Now it's going this way, and I'm thinking, God, that was stupid. Why did I say that? So I don't hear these people either. In a speaker meeting, there was going to be that 45 minutes where I knew nothing was going to be expected of me. And it really gave me, I really often felt like the speaker was talking right to me. You know, I really did. I'm fighting all the time with my husband. And, of course, I'm seeing that the problems in my marriage are his fault. I'm working this spiritual program now. It can't be my fault. I wasn't exactly working a spiritual program at home. And it was bad. It was really bad. With an attitude like that, of course, it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me, who actually looked back. And this momentous occasion occurred when I was about 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I spotted him when he came in the door the first time, and he had a shaved head and a Fu Manchu mustache. My heart started to pound, and I leapt across a couple of rows of chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed and beckoned me off to the side of the room and reminded me that I was a married woman. And I said, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, Pat, you're married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. I said, okay, I don't see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. And she said, no, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You just stay married and act married. Well, I know you're going to understand this. I was obsessed with this man. I know you understand obsession if you're in this room. Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? It was so clear to me. We began what I call the death dance now. Starts with the, you know, deep, meaningful glances across the room, and we're brushing up against each other in the coffee line, and then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting, and it's a little bit complicated to get together. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to go to my place. He's a newcomer. He does not have a place. But you can kind of make anything happen if you want it bad enough. I was working at the time at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently working in Hollywood as well at a porn bookstore. You can't make this stuff up, you know? I arranged a long lunch hour one day at work for somebody to cover for me. He didn't have a car either, so I went to the bookstore and picked him up, and we went to a motel and spent some time together, and I dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon, and it occurred to me in the car driving away from there that I was 10 months sober, and I was behaving exactly the way I'd always behaved. The only reason it hadn't happened sooner, this is the painful truth, is because nobody had asked. I knew that day in the car that I was in a lot of trouble. I'd been here long enough to know I want what you have. I do want to be sober. I want to be here. I don't want to live like this. I've never wanted to live like this. Wanting doesn't change anything. I don't get how you can help me. I was also very afraid to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she had been very clear in her direction. But the bottom line is I don't want to drink. And so I think of in the almost 34 years I've been here, that afternoon is the closest I've been to drinking in all that time. I told her that night what I'd done, and she said, "Pat, you know, I don't think you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober, and you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." Okay, as I just said, I don't want to. I don't get it. Here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. A day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time, I didn't call him. A day at a time, I didn't take his calls. A day at a time, when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, that means that we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. Hello, and I kept moving. I thought that I should explain to him what was going on, and I fortunately ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, "Oh no, I think he'll get the idea." And I really heard that line that is read in every meeting I go to, "Half measures avail us nothing." I really heard it, and I knew I needed to do it 100% her way, and so I did. Now, the obsession, of course, passed. Obsessions always pass. But the really good news, and the part I didn't expect, is that I don't live that way anymore. And I didn't know that that would happen. I had no idea that I really could change how I live my life completely. Another reason I like to tell that story is, I think I mentioned that my friend at work covered for me that day. I went out on this long lunch hour. She knew where I was going and what I was doing. In fact, we talked about it after I got back. And about 6 months later, I left that job, went on to a better job or a different job. But I stayed in touch with that woman, and we'd have lunch together once in a while. And about a year later, I heard from a mutual friend that this first woman's husband had developed a bad drinking problem and that she had taken him to some church in the hopes that his drinking problem might be addressed. And when I heard that, I thought, why would she do that? Why wouldn't she go to Al-Anon or take him to Alcoholics Anonymous? She knew a lot about it. I told her a lot about AA. Well, why would she go there? What I showed her about AA is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. I don't imagine she would be too excited to take her husband over there, you know? It really made me think, I think for the first time in my sobriety, about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a program of attraction, and I did not make it an attractive place for that family to go. I hope that that man got sober someday, but if he did, it's in spite of me. It's really made me consider how I behave. I can't tell you how strongly I feel about this. If we're going to let people know that we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have an obligation to behave in a way that would make it a place that they would be willing to send a loved one or bring or come themselves. And I hope that I've done that. I certainly done it better than I did that day. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. I got a new sponsor. She was sober a long time. And the first thing she said to me is, "I've watched you and listened from afar as you've whined and sniveled about this marriage of yours. I don't want to listen to it. I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife. It wasn't an appealing idea. I didn't want to do it. I didn't see the point. I didn't think the marriage could be saved, you know, yada, yada." But she said, she said, "I don't know what's going to happen to your marriage, but I believe if you, a day at a time, act as though you're a kind and loving wife, you will be making daily living amends to him. And if you do have to walk away down the road somewhere, you might be able to do it without guilt." That got my attention because I had a lot of guilt. a lot of guilt. So I began doing what she said, and it was very simple direction. Her first direction was when I came home from work. When he came home from work, I was to ask him how his day went and look at him and listen while he told me. Oh, sounds pretty simple, I know, but I hadn't been doing it, and my direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. And you know, the first time I asked him, he looked surprised that I was asking, but he said something that had happened at work to him that day. I didn't know any of the people he was talking about because I'd never had any interest in them whatsoever. And when the 10 minutes were up, I left the room. But, you know, when I was driving to the meeting that night, I wasn't crying, and I didn't get it for a long time why. We still had the same fight we always had when I left the house that night, but I get it now. You know, the reason I wasn't crying that night is I finally had taken my focus off of the problem, and I was busy in the solution. Once I get into the solution, I always feel better, no matter what the status of the problem might still be, and that was certainly true in that case. I could talk all night on that topic alone, but I won't. But time passed, and one night I was on my knees, months, close to a year maybe, and I was on my knees saying my prayers, which were very, very short. In the morning, dear God, please help me stay sober today. Amen. And at night, dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. And I started to get up that night off my knees, and I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had already. This is the biggest problem in my life, and I didn't notice when it left. It left, must have been yesterday. No, last week was good, too. I don't know when it happened. It really made a believer out of me with these steps, I'll tell you. I got back down on my knees that night, and I said, God, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and have a happy, sober life. Thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. And my first thought, because this is who I am, is I wish this would have happened when I hated him. See, it's always about me. Always about me. I just kept doing what I was doing. I was a kind and loving wife, and he was sick for a year and a half, and he died, and it was the best year and a half of our marriage, best by a long shot over the next best. I was very, very grateful that I had stayed in that marriage when all of my best judgment said I should get out, because I would have missed that whole year and a half. I was glad that I was there and when he needed me to be there, but in a believable role. In other words, he knew I wasn't just there because he was sick and dying. He knew I was there because I wanted to be there, because I had consistently been there in a kind and loving manner, you know, for that period of that year or whatever it was before that. Also, I think of sponsor directions having this sort of ripple effect. If you get a direction from your sponsor when you're, you know, a month sober or 10 years sober, whenever, if you're anything like me, you do whatever it is today. You want to feel better by tomorrow. It doesn't hardly ever works that way for me. What works for me is I take that action, whatever it is my sponsor's telling me to do, and I incorporate that action into my life somewhere down the road that I cannot possibly see on the day that I get that direction, that my sponsor can't even see, that is going to benefit me in some way. And that is certainly true with this business of learning how to be a kind and loving wife. After my former husband passed away, I started dating a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, Vince, and we got married, and I thought I was going to get through this. We got married, and we were married for 27 years. We had just a wonderful, wonderful life together. Both of us are really active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our house is always filled with AA people, and you know, it was great. It's not to say that life was without problems. We were rich, we were poor. I like rich better, but we were no less happy when we were poor. You know, we always put AA first, and that has stood us in good stead. He was sick a few years ago with cancer. I thought he was going to die then, and he completely recovered and was just absolutely at the top of his game. Had the best job he'd ever had in his life. Looked and felt better than he ever had, and I came home from work and found him dead in his chair of a heart attack. You know, I made one. Here's a good reason newcomers forget in a home group. Very good reason. I made one phone call, and my house was filled with people. And they walked me through it all. You know, they took me to the mortuary, everything. And they continue to watch after me. A few months after he died, we had our elections for the new secretary, the new term, and then, of course, everybody's getting new commitments, you know. And I'm sober a long time, so I thought, well, I don't really need to sign up for a commitment. I mean, there's a lot of new people that don't even get commitments because there's not enough, you know. And so so I didn't sign up for a commitment. So a couple of weeks into the new term, one of the guys in my home group came up to me and said, do you have a commitment? And I said, no. And he said, would you mind being a bat? We're short a basket passer. Would you mind being a bat? Well, of course I said, yes. You have to say yes to an AA request. I'm a member of the Pacific Group. It's a huge meeting, and there's like 800 people. And so we have a lot of basket passers, and it's by sections. So I had section 6, rows 9 and 10 or something like that. Well, section 6, rows 9 and 10 is the very, very last two rows on that side of the room. No offense to you people sitting in the back, but completely losers' rows. I mean, completely. Not at this meeting, of course. Yeah, hi there. I mean, seriously, at a meeting that size, if you're sitting in the last row, you might as well stay at home because you can't even see the speaker's face. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, so the first night I go back and I pass my basket and I get like a dollar in it, you know, from the whole two rows and okay, fine, whatever. And then the next week I go back because I sit near the front of the room because I like sitting near the front of the room. So it takes me a couple of minutes to get back to my section. And somebody else has already passed a basket there. So I thought, oh, I have to be a little faster. So the next week, you know, I like leap out of my chair and I dash back there and he's already passed. And I got it about a month into it. I got it that they didn't need me to be passing a basket. They knew that I needed to be passing a basket. You know, that's what a home group will do for you. You know, I strongly, strongly recommend that you get a home group, a place where people will really watch out for you like that. You know, as I said earlier, this has been truly, truly the saddest year and a half of my life. There have been days when I just thought I could hardly breathe. And yet, there's been a lot of joy this year as well. You know, life isn't just black and white. It's life. And I know that I will be fine one day. I'm really fine now. I mostly cry now. I'm down to crying at the podium. And a little bit at night, you know, at home. But other than that, I've stopped crying at, for example, office staff meetings, and I know they're all grateful. You know, life is good. I'm surrounded by people who love me. I'm sober a long time. I have a lot of friends. I sponsor women. I sponsor a good number of women, and I'm so happy to do that because it gets me out of me. You know, when I'm thinking about them, I'm not thinking about me. And I have different women that I sponsor are going through different things, some health problems and somebody's, you know, family member just died. And so I'm thinking about them. How can I help them? What can I do for them to make their path a little easier today? And anytime I'm not thinking about them, I'm not thinking about me. And anytime I'm not thinking about me, I'm having a better day. It's just that simple, you know. If you're new, I hope that you stay here. I hope if you don't like anything I said, just go to another meeting tomorrow night. I would recommend that you do three things if you're new. One is, I think I already said, get a home group, a place where you really make friends, where people really know who you are. The second thing is obviously get a sponsor. And the third is to make a friend. Somebody around your own length of sobriety you can hang out with and talk to. My first friend's name was Betty. She was sober 3 days less than me, and I told Betty everything before I called my sponsor. You know, it's nice when you're new to hear how stuff's going to sound out loud before you call your sponsor with it. So I'd call Betty and I'd say, here's what I'm thinking of doing, or worse, here's what I've just done. And sometimes she would say, oh, yeah, that sounds good. But mostly she'd say, oh, God, you better call your sponsor right now. And that's a very good kind of friend to have. When we were 10 years sober, she went out. And the last time I saw her was when I was about 25 years sober and I was visiting her in prison. So she didn't go out and have a wonderful life. You know, when we were new, I used to think if I were as smart as Betty, as pretty as Betty, my life would be much better. I think about that a lot. I just think about it a lot. You know, I'm certainly not a more deserving person or a better woman than Betty. As near as I can tell, the difference as to why I'm standing here and she is where she is because I have, to the best of my ability, tried to do what was asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether I wanted to or not, particularly when I didn't want to. You know, this last year I wanted to say no to everything, but I've said yes to everything. And as a result, I'm standing here and I'm feeling pretty good. If you're new, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you stay. Thank you.